separatism. Second, that the vast majority of the people in Crimea, according to, again, various scientific surveys, support and did support joining Russia. Third, that the majority of weapons in the first years of the war were not actually supplied by Russia, but captured from the Ukrainian armed forces and its deserters. And fourth, that in other southern and eastern regions of Ukraine, polling suggests that they neither support a pro-Russian or a pro-Western course, at least not until the recent invasion, which might have changed all that, but that even such a neutral stance could have easily got you accused of being pro-Russian, inviting serious repression. So considering all these developments and also some of the local roots, does the excessive focus over the last 8 years on Russian involvement also obfuscate another important point, which is that the last 8 years, there has also been an internal conflict, basically a civil war within Ukraine, with foreign backing on both sides of the conflict. And in that context, I also want to ask, like, do you think that the so-called pro-Russian population, as I said, a bit of a problematic term, of Ukraine deserves to be more widely heard and understood?
There are actually several groups here. So the most of the people in Crimea, they were actually ethnic Russians. In those areas in Donbass that were controlled by the separatists, the most eastern parts of Donetsk and Luhansk regions, there were also a very large proportion of ethnic Russians, and both Crimea and Donbass were Russian-speaking regions, so overwhelmingly. That should not push us to explain this conflict in a kind of like ethnic conflict narrative, because it was super much more complicated, and the major divisions were probably more like political, the different perceptions over the history and how the Ukraine is supposed to relate to Russia, then the actual ethnicity or language issues. Also, I would not say that they were not unimportant at all. The role of the Russian involvement, of course, in Crimea annexation, it was like very clearly a Russian special operation, and in support, or maybe at least partially in its instigation, the separatist revolt in Donbass, they were crucially important, of course. And now, now many things are starting to be interpreted in retrospective as some kind of prelude to the full-scale invasions that started last month by Russia. And so all those events would be seen now as something building to the full-scale Russian imperial goals that were simply some first stages to that. But of course, it could be possible to discuss some alternatives. What could Ukrainian government do if they would start to negotiate with the separatist rebels when they started the armed revolt in Donbass? Or on the contrary, if Ukraine was not so passively watching how Russia is annexing Crimea, because Ukraine was actually pushed to this passive position specifically by the United States and by the EU, who called Ukraine not to not to respond to the Russian provocation, not to escalate the conflict. And in retrospect, that position could also be challenged. Maybe Ukraine could, I don't know, resist in some way what would be happening, what's happening in Crimea at that moment. But that said, those territories and those populations, they were like organic pro-Russian attitudes. And they could be seen in the polls even before the 2014. And in Crimea specifically, there's been for quite a long time an issue of separatism and support for agenda of for joining Russia. Sometimes more popular, sometimes less popular, but that was not just simply imposed thing. A different question is about the so-called pro-Russian minority in a bigger part of Ukraine, without Crimea and Donbas. That was actually was pro-Russian turned into kind of like very loose and pejorative label to attack the very different positions. So like before 2014, for example, there was quite a significant camp in Ukrainian politics that really called for integrating
Ukraine. Some of the things that I consider generally accurate and some of the things that I've been missing and then wanting to hear your perspective on it. So what's I think generally accurate was that during the war, far-right citizens continued to be active in the rebel army. And that some rebel formations have certainly committed war crimes. Second, that there have been plenty of ceasefire violations by both the Ukrainian army and the rebel forces since the Minsk agreements were signed, the peace agreements we're talking about in that case in 2014 and 15. But one of the key things or some of the key things that were missing in this narrative is, first of all, the Easter ceasefire in 2014, which was there before the conflict had really escalated yet into full-scale war, that was violated by the far-right militia right sector with approval from the central government in Kiev, as its leader has openly admitted in an interview. Second, that the Minsk peace accords, which were signed by Russia, Ukraine, Germany, France, backed by the full weight of constitutional reform for the autonomy of Donbass, and the agreement was very explicit that the rebels would only forfeit their territories to the Ukrainian army after the reforms had been implemented. So in that sense, the ball was largely in Ukraine's court, and they basically dropped it. And finally, according to UN figures that we have, about 80% of, so 80% of civilian casualties between 2018 and 2021, so the last years of the war before the invasion, most of those were in rebel-held territory, suggesting that the Ukrainian army shelling was actually most responsible for civilian deaths in this period. So considering all these facts, before we turn to the actual current invasion, to what extent was the Ukrainian government really interested in peace? And if they weren't, why not?
The Minsk Accords were imposed on the Ukrainian government as a result of the military defeats. The first stage of the Minsk Accords were after the major defeat in August 2014 that was inflicted with the crucial participation of Russian regular forces and not simply the separatist formations. And the second more specific Minsk agreement in February 2015 also followed major defeat of Ukrainian army in Donbas, also again with the crucial impact of Russian regular forces. So at that moment it was covered, but like it's generally accepted by virtually all researchers that yeah, Russian army in some or the other way was there, and that was a crucial factor of Ukrainian forces defeat. So by Ukrainian government, it was perceived as something like an imposed agreement, also mediated by France and Germany, and as it is believed, with crucial input by Angela Merkel, who contributed quite a lot to the text of the final Minsk Accords. So the specific problem for Ukrainian government was that the was specifically the issue of timing, that's the issue that has never been solved, like, during all the 7 years, that the Ukraine would take the actual control over the border with Russia, captured by the separatists, only after the elections would be organized in the separatist held territories. That meant that those elections would be actually not would bring to power the people who would be preferred by Moscow. Realistically understanding how those elections would be organized, and that the Ukrainian parties would hardly be even allowed to participate, or if participating, that would the results would be quite marginal. So in effect, Minsk would bring the Russia preferred people into the local administrations of those territories in Donbas that now would be legitimized by the elections, and the Ukrainian government would now, instead of claiming that we are not going to talk with the unrecognized people who knows who, and we are not speaking to the terrorists, as usual many governments are saying, now they would have to deal with the Russia-approved guys and to discuss with them the actual substance of the autonomy status that would require the constitutional changes in Ukraine. That was hugely problematic for Ukrainian government. For the most people in the Ukrainian government, that is even more for the national liberal civil society, the Minsk Accords were looking like a capitulation on Ukraine. Although that was a capitulation of a very specific nation building project for Ukraine, a nation building project that would see the pro-Russian part of Ukraine as something illegitimate, as not really a part of Ukraine that they would need to really negotiate with and trying to build a common future about. The problem was that the they were rejecting recognizing that they would need to start talking to those guys, that would need to give them at least some share of power. So if the Minsk Accords would be implemented, the Donbas residents would start electing the clearly pro-Russian representatives to the Ukrainian National Parliament, but of course that would create conflictual situations. And within the discourse that was dominant after the Euromaidan, those pro-Russian politicians would be clearly framed as collaborationists, as traitors, that no way there could be any discussion with. And for Russia, that was beneficial because that would give them some leverage, although I would disagree that the Minsk Accords would kind of like fully make Ukraine ungovernable as quite many people claimed, because the only leverage that the separatists would get within the unified Ukraine would be the leverage of the institutionalized and organized secession from Ukraine. In no way they would be able, for example, to block a decision to join NATO or to join EU. Nothing like this was included into the Minsk Accords. But they would have some leverage. There would be some potential for conflicts, even violence. And the Ukrainian government, the civil society especially, they were always claiming, and yeah, especially in the recent years, that any implementation of the Minsk Accords, as they called it, on Moscow terms, although that would like literally follow what they signed in 2015, would mean a truly civil war in Ukraine. And so in order to prevent it, they were not going to implement the Minsk Accords. And there was very little of actual attempts to think how to implement the important parts of the Minsk Accords in a way that would not endanger Ukrainian statehood. And I believe there was a potential for this, and there was a potential to prevent the violence, and Ukrainian government, instead of saying that they would never ever agree on those terms, they could rather seek for the Western government support in order to prevent a possible violence in case of the nationalist part of society would not accept the Minsk terms. And the attitudes of the population in Ukraine were also kind of like ambiguous about Minsk. So in 2015, the polls showed the majority support for the Minsk Accords. But when the people were saying that the Minsk is not actually working, that it's kind of like some kind of like senseless piece of paper that they're discussing for 5, 6, 7 years, and there is no peace in Donbas, the level of support was, of course, declining. But I would not say that for the majority of the population, there was anything like fundamentally unacceptable in the Minsk clauses. It was rather a perception of their inefficiency. And with more active engagement with the Minsk, I think Ukrainian government would be able to find the ways to implement the accords in a way that would not destroy Ukrainian statehood. The problem was that they didn't even try it. And the fundamental reason behind it, there was a need to recognize that Ukraine is actually very diverse, and that some Ukrainians want to see more like closer relations to Russia, and they are also a part of Ukraine. Now, of course, after the full invasion that Russia started, the potential for any Russia-friendly policies are closed for many, many, many years to come. And that's, of course, yes, it's a very tragic result of all that, of very different processes that led to the war.
Yeah, I think tragedy is definitely the right word to use here. I had a lot of other questions, but I want to get to the main one, because we've just gotten to the actual invasion. So I just want to get straight to what I think are some of the most important topics we need to address, which is what the response of the Western governments at the moment is primarily focused on arms deliveries to Ukraine, higher military budgets for NATO, and sanctions against Russia. And the main question is, are these actually helpful in preventing war in Ukraine or ending war in Ukraine? And to what extent can diplomacy be an alternative?
I mean, the problem is this framing that actually this, many people see that only diplomacy is necessary, and there's no need in sanctions and support with the weapons of Ukrainian forces. Other people see that any diplomacy would be a capitulation to Russia, and they need only to double down, and send more weapons and increase the sanctions up to the moment when, yeah, Russia is supposed to collapse, which is not a, may not be necessarily a case. So, I mean, at least for me, it's not actually something that would, that is mutually exclusive. At the initial stages of the war, you may at the same time impose sanctions on the aggressor, send the weapons to the country which is under aggression. That means that the initial goals and demands of Russia on Ukraine could be scaled down and could be more acceptable to Ukraine. So starting from the, as many people believe, from the goal of regime change in Ukraine that Putin pursued with starting the invasion, now, as a result of sanctions and weapon support, the demands of Russia are seemingly much more realistic, I would say so. So now they recognize that there is no way that they would be able to remove Zelensky's government from Kyiv. They retreated from northern Ukraine. In effect, like understanding that they don't have enough forces to take Kyiv, and now they perhaps are trying to concentrate the forces in order to inflict a major defeat to Ukraine in Donbas. And the things that they're negotiating right now are about the neutral status for Ukraine, which at this moment, when Ukraine sees that NATO is not going to defend Ukraine, as many people were saying this before, that the neutral status is something acceptable for Ukraine. There are more like difficult things, as demilitarization and whatever Putin would accept as denazification, because it, basically it's an empty word and many things could be put there. And of course, the most difficult question about recognition of Crimea annexation and like effective future annexation of Donbas, that's a result of recognizing so-called independence of Donetsk and Luhansk republics. But these are already the positions from which the meaningful negotiations could start. And of course, the outcomes of this negotiation would be decided on the battlefield. But I mean, that would work if there is also in parallel very active diplomatic brokerage of a compromise peace settlement. Yes, we increase support for Ukraine in order to bring Putin to the earth from his imperial ambitions. But at the same time, we are actively trying to broker a stable peace settlement acceptable for both Russia and Ukraine that would bring that would stop the war as soon as possible. If that would be a part of the Western strategy, the sending of weapons and sanctions would be justified in my opinion. But if, like for example, Boris Johnson is saying that there is no even need to continue negotiations with Putin, then it looks in a quite different perspective. Because if you simply continue to send weapons and increase sanctions, that means that you are rather interested in prolonging the war and it didn't turn in Ukraine into kind of like Afghanistan in Europe. These thousands, hundreds of thousands lives lost, with cities destroyed, with the economy bombed into pre-modern stage, in order to use Ukraine against Russia with some idea of perhaps bringing down Putin or even dismantling the huge Russian state. In this perspective, this would look completely differently. But in principle, I would not see sanded weapons.
Here, a nuanced response. I think something very important to consider for the peace movement, and I guess a big part of that decision is to push our governments to not be like Boris Johnson, and basically say that no negotiations are needed. We've been talking for almost a full hour. I want to give people the chance to ask questions themselves directly to you. People can put those questions in the chat, or they can turn on their microphone and ask them directly to you. I don't see any questions yet, so I'll wait a few seconds. And and if people are too shy, I'm happy to just continue with all the questions that I wasn't able to ask, because you gave very good and very comprehensive answers, so I didn't manage to get to all of them. But yeah, I'll give people a few seconds now.
All right, could I start with a question?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, first of all, I want to say I feel very sorry what's happening in Ukraine, especially for the people over there. But in my opinion, I think there's a war being fighting between America, especially, and Russia over the territory in Ukraine, over the influence in Ukraine, and that the Ukrainian people are the victims of this war between America and Russia about territory in the world. Having said that, I also want to ask you guys, what you exactly know about Zelensky's main sponsor, Ihor Kolomoysky. He's a Ukrainian oligarch, and Zelensky worked for him from his earliest days through his television station, OnePlus1, and also he announced his presidency for the election through that television. And also that television, hosted advertisement for Zelensky's election campaign. I also looked up and saw that from Studio 95, if I'm correct, the studio who produced the series Servant of the People, where Zelensky was the main actor, that the CEO of this studio, part of 95, I remember now, is now the head of secret intelligence in Ukraine. And the scenario writer of Servant of the People is now the first advisor of President Zelensky. But let's go back to Ihor Kolomoysky. He only didn't have a long connection with Zelensky. I also read through Chris Pluk investigation that Ihor Kolomoysky was also the end owner of Burisma. Burisma were the son of the current president of America worked for, Hunter Biden. And I also saw that some other American board members were there in Burisma. That, and at the end, through the company Seneca, also financed biolabs in Ukraine and gave also patents to investigate with anthrax. So, of course, Putin also said that before, I think 10 days ago, about Hunter's Biden influence in Ukraine and what he did there. So I don't know if I could believe that America was really financing weapons of mass destruction in Ukraine. But I want to ask you guys, what do you know about the influence of Igor Kolomoisky on Zelensky? And about maybe the people around Igor Kolomoisky. The last notice I want to say, I also saw that Igor Kolomoisky plundered the Ukrainian people to his private bank.
I think the question is clear. I want to give the word to Vladimir because we also need to have time for other questions. Thank you for the questions.
I'm sorry for the long question.
That's all right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much for the question. Just a first remark. The war could be perceived as one of the outcomes of the inter-imperialist rivalry about Ukraine. And of course, NATO is not innocent in the story of Ukraine and bears some responsibility. But the primary responsibility for the start of the war is on Putin, because he pressed the button and he had actually other choices. Considering all the processes that were connected to NATO, to the political developments in Ukraine, there have been other options for Putin, and if he chose the war, he bears the primary responsibility also for the all the horrors and loss of lives and destruction that is happening in Ukraine. Returning back to Kolomoisky, just to trying to answer this as short as possible, Kolomoisky is indeed one of the richest and the most notorious oligarchs in Ukraine that built his fortune on quite outrageously exploitation of some of the selective preferences of the state that he, in a corrupt way, lobbied for himself. And also guilty in moving like billions out of Ukraine into the offshore accounts, and private bank was actually part of this scheme. Saying that, and Kolomoisky is like widely hated in Ukraine, and he also has trouble with the United States. I believe he spent for some time in Israel because he was hiding from Ukrainian justice. When Zelensky won the elections, Kolomoisky indeed came back to Ukraine. But I'm saying that Kolomoisky is an actual sponsor or even kind of like a mastermind behind Zelensky would be just false. Indeed, Kolomoisky supported Zelensky during the elections. And you were right about the role of Kolomoisky's own TV channel. Kolomoisky had a huge conflict with Poroshenko, and he was supporting Zelensky primarily because of this. And there was a history of business partnership between Zelensky and Kolomoisky, although it would be an exaggeration to say that Zelensky was kind of like working for Kolomoisky. There is a quite a murky story of Zelensky and Kolomoisky appearing in so-called Pandora Papers, the papers that were published about the offshore companies, where some of the a company linked to Zelensky also appeared. And I mean, that was like a cause of quite considerable scandal that decreased the support for Zelensky in Ukraine. And some connections in these offshore deals with Kolomoisky could also be seen in those papers. But I would not say that Kolomoisky is kind of like influencing Zelensky's policies in any significant way. Kolomoisky was not really prosecuted for what he has done, stealing from Ukraine, but he has also not was not really getting out of all troubles. So the Zelensky also understands that the actual connections with Kolomoisky would be very toxic for him, for Zelensky himself. And he's not trying to fully alienate Kolomoisky, but at the same time, and yeah, Kolomoisky sponsored parliamentary groups were important for passing some of the decisions for which very messy Zelensky's party was not capable to mobilize the majority, which they actually had in the parliament. But I mean, that was extremely diverse and poorly organized party. So in this sense, Kolomoisky was cooperating with Zelensky, but I would not say that he was kind of like imposing his agenda on Zelensky.
I think that's a clear response. I'm going to go to some of the other questions in the chat. So we have one question asking, what about the story that was published last year in Time magazine about a plan from Eric Prince, former CEO of Blackwater, I believe, to finance a private army in Ukraine? And what about the role of private militias in the proxy war in the Donbas, mainly Azov battalion on the one hand and Wagner group on the other? And actually, I think maybe I can throw in one more question there, which asks, can the fight of the rebels in Donbas be considered as a national liberation struggle? What is the class basis of this struggle and where do they stand ideologically?
Oh no, that's just too many questions and very, very different. Honestly, I very poorly recall that story about Eric Prince, and I'm not sure. As I recall, that was just a plan that has never been realized. Why? Honestly, can't say. The private militias, I mean, Azov is not actually a private militia. It's a very wrong understanding of what Azov is. Azov was created by far-right activists of quite extreme background. Andriy Beletsky was the first commander of Azov. And since that, quite soon, Azov was integrated into the National Guard structure, which was subservient to the Minister of Interior, Arsen Avakov, one of the powerful Ukrainian oligarchs. But Azov should never be seen as some kind of like private militia for Avakov. Azov and Avakov had rather kind of like mutually beneficial relations. Both politically and also in kind of like enforcement business. But even after Avakov was dismissed from the minister office last year, Azov is has been still doing quite well. So they've shown themselves as like relatively independent force. The other problem with Azov, of course, is this whole far-right stuff, the use of the wolf's uncle symbol, the start of the kind of like full-scale far-right movement with the National Corps Party, with the paramilitary organization, with all these summer camps for children and so on and so forth, with the international dimension, creating quite extensive links with the Western far right. So that's a big story, and it's been covered quite extensively, even in the Western media, because they clearly understand that something like Azov is truly extraordinary for Europe, at least. And the actual role of Azov, I think it's usually exaggerated. And it is true that Azov is now playing an important role in the defense of Mariupol, of the large city in the southern Ukraine, which is now under extreme assault from the Russian forces, leading to massive destruction of a city of about 500,000 people. And Azov plays an important role in defense of the city. But in the overall structure of Ukrainian forces, the groups of like Azov with the far-right connections are not actually very typical.
Maybe if I can follow up on that, what do you think of, I've seen some analysis from Ivan Kachanovsky a few times and another Ukrainian political scientist, and I mentioned this in my book as well, that some of the influence of the far right in Ukraine can maybe be better understood, not in their specific numbers or their support, but also in their kind of threats that they sometimes issue against the Ukrainian government, for example, when they want to do any compromise with Russia, which is kind of painted as traitors and things like this. Would you consider their influence in this way? Do you think that there is any real fear within, for example, Zelensky's government to compromise because of a threat from the far right, or do you think that's overblown?
I mean, I've been always writing the same in my own studies of Ukrainian far right and Ost-Euromaidan politics. Many people are just stopping at the moment when they see the how few votes the nominally far right party received at the Ukrainian elections, and they say, "Well, what are you talking about? These guys cannot get even more than 3%. So just look at Le Pen, or look at Hungarian Fidesz, or any other large Western far-right party that is actually capable to get a significant number of parliamentary seats. But of course, the real power of Ukrainian far-right, and that's why they were so extraordinary for Europe, that lied in their capacity for street mobilization, in their capacity for, in their much stronger legitimacy within the Ukrainian civil society, and lack of any institutionalized barrier between the liberal and far-right part of the civil society, which is very unusual for Western Europe, and total lack of any left-wing part of active public that was repressed after the 2014. And also the integration into the enforcement structures of the Ukrainian state, control of the weapons, support of the people like Arsen Novakov from the top positions of the government, that of course gave Ukrainian far right a disproportionate influence in Ukrainian politics. And at some critical moments, they could influence the governmental decisions. They could push forward for their own agenda, as I've just beginning our conversation in the, from the very start. The far right were truly a minority among the Euromaidan participants, but they were able to benefit a lot from the. From the outcomes of the Euromaidan revolution and push forward the agendas which were not actually really popular, even among the participants, not speaking the total population of Ukraine. And their threats, very explicit violent threats against the implementation of the Minsk Accords, that were also part of the story. In 2015, Svoboda is a far-right party in Ukraine. A Svoboda activist threw a hand grenade into a police line during the voting for the autonomy status for Donbas. And he killed four police officers and injured, I believe, about 100. And that was already a very clear threat from the far right that they would not allow a real progress in Minsk implementation. And the threats were repeated very explicitly in 2019 when Zelensky was thinking about making some actual progress about Minsk, discussing so-called Steinmeier's formula that gave some algorithm for implementing the Minsk Accords.
Right. It's again a comprehensive answer. I wanna flag up one of the questions I kind of threw in earlier. Because I know you've written quite extensively also about the left in existence rather of the left in Ukraine and specifically also Donbas. So the question was, can the fight of the rebels in Donbas be considered as a national liberation struggle? What is the class basis of this struggle and where do they stand ideologically?
That's a super complicated question. That's probably I missed it before. I mean, you should start from how organic is the actual struggle for Donbas, because the armed revolt was started by a Russian nationalist who was a former FSB, Russian Security Service officer, retired just very recently before the war in Donbas. This very clear reactionary Russian nationalist monarchist agenda. He's truly a far right ideological activist, and he gathered an armed group that currently crossed the border with Ukraine, and. They cross the border with the arms, and that already raises a suspicion that the Russian government could know a lot about their plans. And of course, it's still not very clear to which extent Igor Strelkov, that's the name of the person who started the separatist revolt in Donbas, to which extent his own plans were the plans of Kremlin, like Putin, but there is very strong suspicion that he was coordinating at least with some influential people close to the government. Success of the revolt would ultimately be impossible without the covert Russian support, first with weapons, then with actual incursion of regular Russian forces in 2014 and in 2015. So to which extent you would find here a national liberation struggle, I mean, a national liberation struggle for Russians in Ukraine, I mean, Russia is, could be considered an imperialistic nation. So if you would see this in the nationalistic terms, you would rather need to look at it as a clash of nationalism, Russian nationalism and Ukrainian nationalism. At this moment when Russia is waging a clear aggression in Ukraine, and where the Donetsk and Lugansk republics are clearly on Russian side against Ukraine, whether would you consider this a national liberation struggle? That would be a very extreme abuse of this war.
Thanks, Vladimir. I'm wanting to round up. There is one last question from Jeff, saying, you said that the Maidan uprising was never supported by a majority of the population, but if there had been a democratic outcome and compromise supported by the majority, and he's talking kind of a what if in 2014, 13, would it still not have been a shift to the left, resulting in a more liberal direction and lessening the power of the oligarchs? And regarding the pool between Russia and NATO before 2014, weren't the vast majority of Ukrainians in support of neutrality? So what the situation was basically around that time and what a democratic outcome at the time would have looked like? Of course, it's a kind of what if question, but that's the last question from the audience.
So the Euromaidan was not actually about NATO. It was about the association agreement with the EU, which was seen by many Ukrainians as a kind of a first step towards EU membership, although it was not. It was primarily a free trade agreement with some abstract words about corruption, democracy, and so on. But primarily this was about free trade zone. And as we actually have been saying this from the very start, and as this have been recognized lately by many Ukrainian people in the government, in business, that the terms of the free trade zone with the EU were not favorable for Ukrainian economy for many different reasons. So the distribution of the attitudes about EU before the Euromaidan protest started was more like split. It was not actually about neutrality. It was about something like 40-45% who supported EU integration, and about maybe 35-40% who supported integration with the Russia-led Eurasian Union. At that moment, it was called Customs Union. It's Russia, Belarus, and Kazakhstan. So there was an initiative to have an actual referendum on the EU on the choice between EU or the Customs Union, but that initiative was undermined by Yanukovych government, which made a huge number of mistakes that resulted in toppling of Yanukovych. And about NATO, before 2014, the support for NATO was actually a small minority within Ukrainian society, less than 20%. Most of Ukrainians were split between those who supported a military alliance with Russia, and that sounds extremely ironic and tragic at this moment, and those who were supporting staying at non-alignment status for Ukraine. After the Euromaidan, the support for Russia went down because of the annexation of Crimea, because of the war in Donbas. And many people started to see NATO as a kind of like protection against Russia, and support for NATO increased up to 40%. But until the last year, it was hardly ever above 50. So claiming the real majority within Ukraine, and we also need to understand that since 2014, the Polish companies stopped doing service in Russia next Crimea and in the separatist controlled Donbas. So that pro-NATO attitudes were skewed because of the exclusion of the most pro-Russian regions in Ukraine. And so during the war, it's just simply very difficult to organize a proper survey. And it would be very interesting to know whether the war and the perception of NATO and how and the actual lack of support from NATO, how it influences the attitudes of Ukrainians. Is it up because of the war started by Russia, or it's actually down because of the disappointment about NATO?
Thank you very much, Vladimir. I have to start rounding up now. We're exactly at time, so I want you thank you so much for joining us and illuminating us with all your insights, which are very important at this moment. I want to thank everybody for tuning in, of course. As I said, this was Decolonial Learning Session number 15. We have one every month, so feel free to join to track our agenda and join for the next one. In this case, we actually, because this was a special session, we have another one coming Thursday about Dutch colonialism in Indonesia. There is a link for donations in the chat. We're all doing this voluntarily, so any donations are helpful. And that's it. I want to thank you all for coming, and I'm gonna stop the recording now, but feel free to hang out a little bit. I won't immediately shut down the Zoom session, so if you want to talk amongst each other, that's very welcome. Again, thank everyone for joining, and that was it.
Yeah, thank you for listening and for very interesting questions.
The recording has stopped.
Yeah, sorry, but I would need to leave because it's I need to
of course.
To let our room.
And it may not be such a bad idea if I never went home again.